This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I knew my rent was gonna be late about a week ago. I worked my ass off, but I still can't pay so. But I got just enough to get off in this club and have me a good time before my time is up. Hey, let's get it now.
Ooh, I want the time of my life.
Yeah.
Oh, baby.
Pitbull, he's global. Like All Marine Radio is about to be.
Look like Mariah, took another shot. Hold it, drop it like it's hot.
All right, I got no time for that. All right, let me tell you about Sebastian Younger and his book, and you're going to hear him right now. Sebastian Younger, I first crossed paths with. I first heard his name when he was in Ramadi. And he, in 2004, he and his photographer, and his photographer was killed a few years ago. And he made a documentary about his photographer. Anyway, he wrote a book called Tribe on homecoming and belonging. Okay. And so that's what we're going to talk. So I saw it, and because I use the word tribe, I saw, you know, I'm like, Younger ripping me off. What the hell? I'm not going to read you an expert. So excerpt from it. So you can buy the book. It's a good read. It's a relatively short book, which is the kind of books I tend to like. I would recommend it to you, but. But here, in his own words, is Sebastian Younger, part two, part one. There's two parts. That's Toby Keith. It's country music for all you rednecks out there. Yeah.
He left the yellow rose.
I can sing the hell out of that song.
Table beside my bed with a short little note said I had a good time and was written in lipstick red. She didn't sign her name. I wonder if that's a little secret that she keeps. Ooh, she's walking around in my sleep.
Yeah. 801 here on the west coast of the United States, 1101 on the east coast. Joining me is Sebastian Younger. Sebastian, good morning. How are you?
Hey, I'm very well, thank you.
All right. First of all, thanks for taking time out of your day and joining us on All Marine Radio. We appreciate it.
Hey, well, it's a pleasure.
All right. First of all, Sebastian, we need to learn a little bit about you so we can take anything you say seriously. So, born and raised where?
I was born and raised right outside of Boston, and I now live in Manhattan in New York City.
So now, my dad managed the Red Sox, was the manager when the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs. I have a lifelong hate of everything involving Massachusetts. Tell me that you survived and adjusted well to being from Boston and the wicked lifestyle that you guys all, the wicked egocentric world that you live in there.
My dad grew up in Europe. My mom grew up in Ohio. And so I had a lot of other influences. And,
oh,
you know,
thank God.
Boston is a lovely city, but I find that it's also limited in some ways, as you're saying. And, I wound up in New York, which is the craziest, most unlimited freak show you can imagine. I absolutely love it. The whole world's crammed into that city, and it's an amazing experience.
All right, so you survived the experience of Massachusetts. We can now go on with the interview, just so you know. So, where did you go to college?
I went to Wesleyan in Connecticut. I majored in anthropology, which very much. much became part of my work as a journalist.
I was going to ask you, how did I've seen some of your other work, some of your nonfiction writing and whatnot. I was going to ask you how you kind of loop back into anthropology. So you grew up with it.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, you know, my father was from Europe, and so I looked at America through slightly foreign eyes just because of him.
Right.
Anthropology, of course, is the study of human society, and I learned to do that even with my own society. And I think it served me very well as a journalist. I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona. I was a really good distance runner in college, and I trained with the best Navajo runners, and I wrote a thesis about Navajo long distance running. And so I just have this training to look at society sort of from the outside and try to disassemble it and understand it. And, you know, ultimately, that's what I've been in all the war zones that I've been in. And then when I finally started accompanying American soldiers in wars, I did the same thing to them. Like, how does this work in a platoon? How do men function in a platoon in combat? What are their interactions? Like, how does it work?
Talk to me about, so you graduate from college, and did you want to be a writer at that time? Because I think most of us, our first encounter with you is the perfect storm. So you get out of college, and what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I wrote a thesis on Navajo long distance runners, and mm-hmm. writing that thesis was like incredibly exciting to me. I was a sort of indifferent student. I was much more of an athlete than a student. But writing the thesis really lit me up. I thought, oh, that sort of is probably close to what journalism is. You research something and you write about it. Maybe I'll be a journalist. Very sort of naive thought process. But I started trying to write freelance for newspapers and magazines and such. I couldn't make much of a living at it. Waited tables to supplement my income. And I wound up doing this incredible job. I wound up working as a climber for tree companies. So I would work,
nice.
You know, 50, 60, 70, 80 feet in the air, topping out trees, taking them down piece by piece, you know, with a chainsaw on a rope. Very dangerous, tricky work. And I actually got hurt doing it, as most of us do. And that got me thinking about dangerous jobs. And I started writing about dangerous jobs. And at the time, I was living in the town of Gloucester, which is a fishing town in Massachusetts. And a huge storm hit the coast in 1991. And sank a local boat named the Andrea Gale with six men. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll write about the Andrea Gale, and that will be, you know, I'll write about commercial fishing as a dangerous job. And that eventually turned into the perfect storm. But I was also trying to learn how to be a war reporter. So I was, at the same time that I was writing that book, I was going overseas and reporting on wars, the early 90s.
So how does reporting on war get on your, you know, your, well, so explain to me now, the path to this idea of I want to be a war reporter. Why?
Well, my father grew up during war in Europe in World War II. His father was Jewish, and they came here during the war when the Nazis rolled into Paris. And so my family was very affected by war. And you know, I grew up during Vietnam, obviously, and I was like a lot of boys. When I was young, I was sort of curious about it. You know, war is this like very sort of ancient archetypal compelling thing, and I was curious about it. And when I was in my 30s, one of the dangerous jobs I wanted to write about actually was war reporter. I thought, well, that's drilling, you know, logging and commercial fishing, drilling for oil, war reporter. I mean, those are all like very dramatic and dangerous professions that I wanted to understand better, and I was going to sort of do all of them in order to write about them. So I went off to Bosnia in 1993 during the Bosnian Civil War. I mean, this is way before the U.S. was involved, obviously. And I was in Sarajevo during the siege of Sarajevo, and I very gradually learned how to be a freelance war reporter and just loved it. I felt like the most meaningful, important, incredible job to have. I could believe what I was doing.
My guest this morning, privileged to have him, and is Sebastian Younger. He's a documentary filmmaker, he's a writer, and he's written a book called Tribe. And when somebody asked me, they said, hey, have you seen Younger's book Tribe? I said, what? And I said, he's knocking off my stuff. Did he footnote it? Is he copying me? What the hell is he doing? So, because that's how I describe our tribe, certainly here in the Marine Corps. And he's gracious enough to give us an hour of his time, and certainly happy to have him. So, to Sarajevo, It's what were your first experiences like? Was it in terms of pulling it apart? I grew up like you did, Sebastian, in terms of, you know, post-World War II, post-Korea, Vietnam. But the stuff we saw on TV, the stories we heard were about World War II and, you know, high tide in the Pacific and victory in Europe. And it was very much the culture that I grew up in. I want you to, can you relate the story about your selective service notification?
Yes.
And what your dad told you? Because I had similar moments like that in which you're being a punk, essentially, and mine were athletics. I remember getting in the car one day, and I was pissed because my dad in Major League Baseball, he was a catcher, so he taught me how to catch. And a catcher assumes a different position when there's runners on base. And my Little League coach was a Red Star Laundry delivery driver, Ron Batson, and he said, I don't want you to do that. And I'm 11. Mr. Batson, that's how you do it. And he says, I don't want you to do it like that. And so I get in the car after practice, and I'm pissed, right? My mom looks at me. She says, what's wrong? I said, Mr. Batson doesn't know anything. And she said, oh, really? And so I explained it to her, and she looks at me, and she says, do you want to play on that team? And I said, yeah. And she said, who's the coach? I said, Mr. Batson. And she told me, you do what Mr. Batson says, and if you think your father would tell you any different, you're mistaken. Do you understand me? Took a drag off her parliament, right, and blew the smoke out the window, right? But you know what? It was exactly what, as a young man, as a young boy, I needed to tell me, which was, hey, there's authority. This guy's giving his time. He's coaching you. You do what he tells you to. And your story struck me in the exact same vein in terms of you learned a life lesson from this conversation with your father.
Yeah, I love that story, by the way. And, you know, the truth is, we all, humans are wired to want to belong to groups, And the deal is, if you're going to belong to a group, you play by the group's rules. That's the deal. Or don't belong to the group. Like, it's really, really simple. And, you know, we try to have it both ways, but obviously we can't. So, so when I was growing up, I mean, just to give context, I mean, when the boys in the neighborhood played war, like boys do,
right. We
had to figure out who was going to be the Germans and who was going to be the Americans, right? I mean, we were playing World War II. I mean, that's what, you know, in the 60s, that's the war that you played when you were a boy. But, you know, Vietnam was going on, and every adult I knew, I was from a very liberal part of the, very, very liberal town, very liberal family, very anti-war. Every adult I knew was against the Vietnam War. So when I turned 18, and I knew that there'd been a draft, but then they stopped the draft. So when I turned 18, not only was I anti-war, anti-Vietnam, anti-draft, I mean, and then I got my draft card in the mail, my selective service card at 18, in 1980. Girls don't get this. A lot of girls don't even know that this exists. But boys know, because we all get it at 18, a card from your government that says, we want to know where you live in case we need to draft you. I was so shocked. I was like, what the hell is this? I thought the draft was over with. Like, what? And I showed it to my father, and I said, I'm not signing this, right? Like, this is ridiculous. And he said, oh, you're definitely signing that. And he explained what I already knew, but he grew up in France, and first in Spain and then in France. And he said that his country was saved by the United States, that tens of thousands of young American men were buried, died in his country, and many were buried in his country, saving the world from fascism. And I'll never forget, he said, you don't owe your country nothing, and you might owe your country your life. And if the government, in the future, if the government decides to fight a war that you disagree with, that you think is not necessary, then it's your moral duty to protest it and oppose it. But it may be a war that's necessary, like World War II was, in which case it's your moral duty to fight it. And you don't know which it's going to be yet. So you sign that draft, you sign your selective service card, and you make your decision later. And once you put it like that, I was suddenly incredibly proud to be signing this card. It made me feel like I was part of something bigger, part of something greater than myself. It completely changed it from a kind of bureaucratic manipulation to what it really is, which is, look, you know, as he said, you don't owe your country nothing. We're all part of this thing, and it's, you know, it might cost all of us in some ways, and we have to acknowledge that.
Sebastian Younger, my guest this morning. You know, it's interesting. I take my kids to veterans cemeteries. I used to when they were little, And, you know, a lot of the American Legion volunteers and the DAV people that put flags up on Memorial Day at cemeteries all around the country, they're getting older. So I would bring four kids. And if they had a couple friends, I'd bring them and I'd explain, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go help these people put in flags. And they'll explain what they're doing. And my oldest son comes back. We're doing this in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And he was doing the math on the tombstones. And he comes and he says, will you come look at this? And I said, yeah. And he said, Dad, he was 17. I didn't think you could join until you were 18. I said, well, these guys would lie. If, like, he's a big hairy kid and he's 15. He lies on his birthday and he joins the Army or the Marine Corps or the Navy or the Army Air Corps at the time. And he looked at me and he said, really? And I said, hey, can I just tell you something? And he said, yeah. And I said, this country didn't get to be the way it is because nobody gave a shit about it, okay? This kid's life dream was not to be here at the age of 17 with a piece of marble sticking out of his forehead. And you know what you owe him? You owe him to do this and to serve in your community. You don't have to join the military, but this country's a great country because people care, and what you owe it is a little bit of service in your life. Got it? My kids could recite that for you verbatim, by the way. But you know what? It's so true. And Sebastian, before we go to Sarajevo, can you just give everybody a thumbnail version of what it is to be a member of a tribe and what it is to be part of a tribal society?
Well, yeah, of course. And we'll all recognize this when you hear it. I mean, in the ancient sense, it is the community of people immediately around you that you depend on for your physical survival. You depend on them for sharing resources, for gathering food, for communal defense. And because you're depending on them for your physical survival, you're depending on them for your emotional needs. I mean, that's how it's always been. Humans are not a solitary species. We die when we're alone. We survive as a group. We're wired to belong to groups. It helps us survive physically, but it also provides for our emotional needs, which are incredibly important. I mean, that's as important as food. And so one of the sort of blessings and tragedies, both, of modern society is that with wealth comes the ability to lead individual lives. And you don't literally need your neighbors to help defend from an enemy, you know, the enemy, right? You don't need your neighbors to help you gather food so you have food to eat all winter. All that stuff has been outsourced, which liberates us from these terrible tasks, right? I mean, it's a wonderful thing. But the downside is it also deprives us of the immediate experience of community and tribal connection and this sort of group identification, which has kept humans safe and feeling comforted and like they belong to something. You know, for hundreds of thousands of years, and we've actually lost that. And, you know, I'm not here to say it's a good trade or a bad trade. I mean, I'm a journalist, and I don't offer opinions. But it is important to sort of, like, articulate, to point out and identify that it is a trade-off, that there is a downside to this. And what does that downside cost us psychologically? I mean, we have to understand that so that we can protect ourselves from it.
Sebastian Younger, our guest, we're talking about anthropological stuff this morning. And if you have a question or comment, the text line 714-661-8107. You can email live.allmarineradio@gmail.com, or you can call the program 714-884-4294. One of the things that struck me that in the book is where you write, the most affluent women in the world are in Western Europe and the United States. The highest suicide rate among women is in Western Europe and the United States. And I don't know why that struck me as this migration from a tribal society where you read the comments of women and how happy they are, how connected they are, and how they govern their own life to the highest suicide rate in the world. It's pretty stunning statistic. But after, in reading, I guess the more I read of your book, the more I understood that I probably shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think you're actually referring to a study that I found that compared depression rates, and of course suicide and depression are very closely linked, but depression rates in different societies. So they looked at depression rates among women in rural North America and urban North America, and rural Nigeria and urban Nigeria. Now, Nigeria is an incredibly poor, violent, chaotic, corrupt, frightening place. I've worked there as a journalist. North America, we all know what that is. So what they found was that the highest rates of depression were in women in urban areas, and the very highest depression rate was urban women in North America, which was the wealthiest group. The lowest depression rate was rural women in Nigeria and in an extremely poor society. And again, it's not, you know, it's sort of counterintuitive, but it's not a mystery. The wealthier you are, the more individualistic a life you can lead. And there's upsides to that, but the downside is that that makes people vulnerable to depression. And when you're buffered, when you're surrounded by people and necessary to them, you know, on some level you're too busy to bother being depressed. I mean, I looked at the Blitz in London. You know, of course, London got bombed for six straight months and they lost 30,000 people during those 6 months to German bombs. Terrible time. And you had strangers sleeping shoulder to shoulder on subway platforms and, you know, objectively just miserable, right? But what are the upsides? Well, class distinctions disappeared. Everyone sort of joined society, you know, joined to help society, to help the group survive. They basically tribalized. And the authorities were prepared for mass psychiatric casualties. Of course, you bomb a civilian population like that, there's going to be mass hysteria on the streets and looting and whatever. Now, the opposite happened. I mean, when you hardship brings out the best human behaviors, not the worst human behaviors. And, you know, as one official said, now we have neurotics driving ambulances. I mean, everyone felt needed, and the result was that admissions to psych wards went down during the bombings, not up, they went down. The crisis and the communalism that it engendered buffered individuals from their psychological demons.
You know, so I'm reading your book, and I can see the train wreck coming, right? I read through the initial part of the book and then kind of where you get to Sarajevo, and I'm thinking, I can see the train wreck coming, right? We have young people that grow up in this fragmented world, this American culture that we have, and in America's modern culture, and then they're immersed in, they join the military. They become part of a tribe. Then the tribal experience is put on steroids if you go fight for your country. Now, not only are you in that tribe, but now you're in the most stressful conditions one can imagine, where you truly depend on each other for your daily existence and hopefully tomorrow's existence as well. And then you come home. And you're released from that obligation, and then you go back into that fragmented society. And so I'm reading it going, it's a tragedy, right? Just the path that we go, that we're launched on, should we be surprised with all the problems that veterans are currently experiencing given that kind of trajectory?
Yeah, and absolutely. No, we should not be surprised. And, you know, it's not even about trauma. I mean, the word everyone uses is PTSD, and the T stands for trauma. And the fact is, you don't have to have been in combat. I mean, most soldiers are not in combat. Only about 10% of the military experiences any combat at all. But the rate of diagnosed PTSD is far, far higher than that, and the estimates vary by 20%. Some say 30, some say in the 40s. Who knows? But it's very, very high. It's way higher than 10%. And I looked at Peace Corps volunteers. So when they come back to society, I mean, you know, you spend 2 years in a small village in Cameroon or wherever. That's a tough transition, right? That's a tough life, but it's a communal life. It's very interconnected. People get used to it, just like soldiers in a platoon.
Right.
It's our evolutionary past, sort of resurrected for us, and people respond very back, and 25% of returning Peace Corps volunteers slide into a deep depression when they come back, roughly equivalent to soldiers. So one of the things that's happening to veterans isn't necessarily that they were traumatized on the battlefield. Maybe they were, but regardless, they're all experiencing this radical transition to a society that doesn't really have a center. And that is hard on everybody, whether you're a soldier or not. We're not wired for that, and we go into a depression. If you take a chimpanzee and take him out of his, take him out of his cage with this troop of other chimpanzees and put him in a cage by himself, that chimpanzee will show signs of depression, right? And that's exactly what happens when you take a soldier out of a platoon and drop him or her back down in the great American suburb, and they're sleeping by themselves in an air-conditioned room all of a sudden. I mean, I heard a story from a guy who was, multiple deployments. He's a guy that I knew out at OP Restrepo, where I was with a platoon of combat infantry off and on for a year. Great guy named Dave. And he told me that he read my book, and he told me this story. He said when he got back off of some deployment, combat deployment, I mean, he's like the real deal, this guy, right? And so they got back in the Army, decided to treat everybody to their own hotel room, right?
Nice.
They stuck all these guys in their own hotel room. He said the first night, they've been sleeping shoulder to shoulder in the dirt for a year, right?
And
so the first night, he couldn't get to sleep. Second night, he couldn't get to sleep. Third night, he still can't get to sleep. But one in the morning, he hears a knock on the door. He opens the door, and it's one of his buddies from the platoon who's standing there with his pillow under his arm saying, can I sleep in here with you? Because they just fixed each other, right? So that's such a great example of how hard this transition is to go from collective experience to an individual experience.
Talk to me. Now let's go back to Sarajevo. Sebastian Younger continues with us here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Hey, Sebastian, just so you know, the mission of All Marine Radio is post-combat related mental health. We come here every day, we talk about the culture of the Marine Corps, and then we kind of bait and switch everybody by talking about mental health when they're not looking, hoping that, guys that are kind of going down the road of isolation will reconnect, will listen to other people's experience, know that we're experiencing these things in the collective, even though we're by ourselves, will reconnect to their tribe, to their battle buddies, and continue this thing, be it through social media or some other way, and remain connected and kind of go through this together. And we know that if as you've seen and documented, we know that if we go through it together, we can get through just about anything. And so that's what the mission is. So again, your visit here this morning is awesome and right on the mark. Let's go back to Sarajevo. Talk to us about what you saw in Sarajevo that contributed to the book.
Well, I was there in the early 90s. For those of your listeners who don't know, Sarajevo was in Bosnia, and it's a modern city that was basically in the fall of 92, summer of 92, was surrounded by a modern army, the Bosnian Serb Army, and tanks and artillery and everything else. Completely surrounded, besieged, cut off, and they basically used the civilian population for target practice for 3 years. And they managed to kill and wound one-fifth of the population, the civilian population of Sarajevo. And the people of Sarajevo, along with the mafia and the army, what little there was of it, managed to defend the city, neighborhood by neighborhood, got, 17-year-olds who had never shot a gun, fighting a professional army and doing it, right? But people were reverted in Sarajevo, and this is the city that I saw, were reverted to a kind of Stone Age existence. I mean, people, you'd see men in business suits dragging firewood down the street to cook their meal with. You'd see them cooking coffee at coffee break in the courtyards of their buildings, over a twig fire. That's how they make coffee, guys in suits, right? You saw vegetable gardens in the median strips of highways. There were little paddle wheels in the Miljaška River for charging car batteries, jury-rigged paddle wheels. The people lived in the basements of buildings. I mean, it was a Stone Age existence in a modern city. And they did it. They survived, right? And I went back last summer and met a woman named Nizara who was a journalist. And, she interviewed me for something. And then I basically asked if I could interview her because she was so interesting. So Nizara war broke out, she was 17, and she wasn't paying much attention to the politics and all that, and suddenly the war started. And within a few days, a tank round hit her parents' apartment, and a shell fragment hit her leg, and almost took his leg off. And her father rushed her, 17-year-old girl, her father rushed her to the hospital, like, in his arms. And they operated on her, and they managed to save her leg, but they had to operate on her without anesthesia, because there was none in that city at that point. And there was a whole long line of other wounded people waiting to be dealt with, you know, treated. It was real Civil War surgery, basically. And she survived. And so when I met her, we were talking about all this. She said, you know, she literally lowered her voice because she was a little embarrassed. We were outside of the cafe. And she said, you know, the war was terrible, but the truth is, we all miss it. We miss it because we were better people then. We were generous, and we were selfless, and we looked after each other. And now, you know, the war ended, and now we're a wealthier society, and we're all doing our own thing, and we're not as good as people. We're not as good as we were, and we all miss being the better versions of ourselves that war required. And she said that there was graffiti in Bosnia that says, referring to the war, that says things were better when they were bad, which sort of sums it up. And so, again, I go back to my point that when bad things happen, humans respond incredibly well. They don't act in antisocial, terrible ways. They actually act in very noble ways. Evolution wouldn't have it any other way. I mean, if danger and hardship and stress produced our worst human behaviors, we wouldn't have survived as a species. And we're the descendants of people who acted well in those circumstances. And it feels good to act well. So I never forgot that. Things were better when they were bad. And then I look at and I don't mean this sarcastically, I mean our truly wonderful, peaceful modern society has so many blessings and benefits, but it does not, because we're so wealthy, it does not call out our better natures. It allows us to be individualistic and maybe even selfish and isolated. And so when soldiers come back from war, whether they were actually in combat or not, doesn't matter. They come back from this very close-knit communal situation, and they come back to this society, and of course they get depressed. You know, it's called PTSD. I think for most of them it probably isn't really PTSD, it's something else. But of course they get depressed. And they do what comes naturally. They band together. They try to keep that group together, even in the civilian world. So, you have groups of veterans groups, the Marines, and all that stuff. That's great, but it's actually a short-term solution. The real solution is to change society so that everyone enjoys the benefits of communalism. The veterans are kind of saving themselves with each other, which completely makes sense. The real problem isn't that the vets have a problem. The real problem is society. And the long-term solution is to make society a more communal enterprise somehow.
That's another show, okay. we'll tackle that small little anecdote on another show, Sebastian. I want to ask you a quick comment. I had the Marine that went to the top of Everest on last week. His name's
yep.
He's a former Staff Sergeant Charlie Lindell, and he talked about, and I want you to comment on this. He said, I needed a challenge in my life that would force everything else to the side. I needed to feel alive again. I needed to be able to focus on something the way I used to focus. He was a grunt in Fallujah, lat moved to EOD, and where he got injured in the Helmand province up in the vicinity of Sangin. And so he said, and that's what Everest did for me. It consumed me. It forced everything else to the side. Now, I still deal with my demons, but I had something that I was passionate about, a direction my life was headed in to, and I became me again. Sebastian, talk to us about how important that is in terms of becoming me again, coming home, being employed. But I would say more than being employed, your passion being part of your life in terms of coming back and becoming you again.
Well, you'll notice with the guy you're mentioning, I can't remember his name. I know about this expedition. It's an extraordinary thing.
Charlie Lindell.
Right. When he became himself again, it wasn't, he wasn't doing a solo trip to the top of Everest. He was part of a group, and a group that he cared about, and I assume he would have risked his life to help save anyone else in that group, people want to be of service. They want to be part of something. And again, the blessing and the tragedy of modern society is that we kind of have made life so easy that we don't need to be part of a group to survive. We've outsourced all those struggles, which is great, but there's a downside, and he's experiencing that downside. The problem with that solution is it's a short-term solution. I mean, eventually you come back from Everest, and you're still back in society here. What do you do? I don't quite know what the answer is. I think eventually veterans are going to have to figure out how to feel like themselves and feel important and essential and necessary, even during the humdrum pace of everyday life. They're going to have to do it, right? They're not always going to be scaling Everest or fighting Fallujah, fortunately. And I saw a wonderful painting by Winslow Homer. We all know who that is. Amazing painter for the last century.
Right.
And, or for the 1800s, rather. And he painted a young man in a field with a scythe, right? We all know what a scythe is.
Right.
He's harvesting wheat. He's in a wheat field, and he's harvesting wheat with a scythe. And the painting was made in the fall of 1865. So the Civil War had just ended a month earlier. The Civil War, right? The big, bloodiest carnage this country's ever gone through. And the title of the painting is A Veteran in a New Field. Just think about that. Like, that guy was a soldier 3 or 4 months earlier, and he came back to his community, to his family, his community, and they were like, listen, man, we still need you. Like, welcome home, but here's the side, get to work. And, of course, people who are physically or psychologically really damaged have to be taken care of. Of course, we're a compassionate society. But there's something enormously psychologically healthy about telling veterans, listen, don't stop now. Great job over there. We still need you doing a great job. And one of the complicated downsides of disability benefits is it allows veterans to think that they're not needed, that they can kind of coast. Society not only doesn't need them, but can actually just support them. And that, again, is a blessing in some ways, but there's a real psychological downside to it. And it's a message, the coded message is, thank you for your service. We actually don't need you anymore. Here you can sort of like rely on this for the rest of your life, and you know we're going to move on. And I understand it comes from a benevolent place, it comes from a compassionate, caring place. But actually, for some people, in the long run, lifelong disability like that, I think it might be sending the wrong message about whether you're necessary or not to our society.
I think the operative word when you were talking about that, you said we need you. I don't think there's any, you know, there's some really powerful things that you hear in your life and that you say to people. I think one of the most powerful things you say to younger people is, I believe in you, I know you can do it. I think when you tell somebody else you need them, there's nothing. And when you, the pronoun we is significant. We as a group, we need you. You know, when you, especially to a veteran, we need you. I mean, it's like saying, the response is, I'm all in, what do you need? And so, because it's what we know, right? You are pinging on a chord that we sing all the time that we've lived our lives to, and it makes total sense to us. And I've got a text message. Matt, great show this morning. Sebastian is confirming everything I have felt but couldn't articulate. Thanks for the good work. A corporal, United States Marine Corps. Sebastian, we have to take about a two-minute break, and then when we come back, I want to kind of maybe continue with the benefits discussion, what you see as good, you know, and also how this book kind of percolated up into you. And I also want to touch on national service. So hold on real quick, and we'll be right back. Sebastian Younger joins us this morning, and very, very privileged to have him. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue, 8:40 on a Wednesday morning. Mike McNamara with you. Sebastian Younger graciously holding on and hanging with us through the break. And Sebastian, let me just tell you, first of all, I've admired your work because it's the documentaries that you made just tell the story, and you get out of the way of it, and it has a huge impact when people go to see it. I went to see Restrepo, I told you, before we came on at USC, and the girl I went with, her name's Kim Hegley, yoga instructor. She'd gone to Walter Reed to do some work with veterans who had returned. But so moving to see such a raw depiction of life on an outpost and what people go through on a daily basis, what they deal with, the humor of it, and just what it truly is there. And so just want to say I'm a huge fan of your work. And again, thank you for coming on this morning and doing this.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Talk to us about, in the book, there's a chapter that you call Awake. And you come home from Afghanistan after after spending some time, I don't know if the appropriate word is embedded, but embedded with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who you know, we all lament his loss. But talk to us about that chapter, Awake, where you begin to deal with your own personal experiences.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of each, there's four sections, four chapters in the book, and each one starts with a very short personal anecdote. And, you know, of course, as a journalist, I've experienced what has come to be known as PTSD, myself. And I didn't even know the term for it because I started being affected by combat long before the United States was at war. I was covering wars through the 90s. And I didn't know what was going on. It was very confusing, but I had real psychological consequences. I was in northern Afghanistan in the fall of 2000, so a year before 9/11, with the Northern Alliance, and they were the militia led by Ahmad Shah Massoud who were fighting the Taliban. And they were defending about a fifth of the country that the Taliban were not able to take over. I was heavily Tajik and Uzbek areas, and they were fighting like crazy to preserve them from the Taliban rule. And thank God, because we had allies on the ground after 9/11 who really were the ground troops, the shock troops that took Kabul. I was there with those guys. That I never saw American forces. It was the U.S. Air Force air power, you know, in the air, and Afghans on the ground. And those are the guys I was with. And so at any rate, I was with Massoud's forces fighting the Taliban. Back then, the Taliban had an air force. They had MiGs. They had tanks. They had everything, right? So you were fighting those guys then, you were really getting pounded. And we did. And I came back to New York where I lived pretty altered, but I didn't know it, right? I was a young man. I didn't think anything affected me. I kind of shrugged it off. And then one day I went down into the subway. It was crowded and, everything suddenly felt like a threat. The trains were going too fast. They were going to jump the rail and somehow plow into me and kill me. The crowds down there were going to turn on me and beat me to death. I mean, the lights were too bright. I mean, everything was a threat. And I intellectually knew that I wasn't making sense. I knew that. But it felt like I was in mortal danger. And I literally backed up against the iron support column and to sort of came with defensive crouch, you know, and waited for it. And then when I couldn't take it anymore, I sprinted out of there and, you know, walked wherever I was going. I didn't catch the combat because in the combat that I'd been in, I wasn't in any small crowded underground spaces. Like, that just wasn't, it wasn't replaying a bad experience. So I didn't connect to the combat, but it's exactly what the problem was. I was having short-term acute, as it's called, PTSD, that for most people, about 80% of people, resolves itself within, you know, some weeks or months, which is what happened with me.
How did that impact you? Did that kind of get you curious in terms of writing a book like this, in terms of going and coming? What's the genesis of the book, Tribe?
Well, I mean, honestly, at the time, I just thought I was going crazy. And I just decided to tough it out. I didn't know, as I said, I didn't know the term PTSD. Thought I was going crazy. I didn't seek psychological help because, in this weird way, I was like, well, if I'm going crazy, no one can help me, so I might as well keep this quiet as long as I can. And and eventually, you know, it just went away, as it does for most people who have been traumatized. Right. And you know, soldiers don't own trauma, right? I mean,
no.
It's a civilian thing, too. I mean, people have car accidents. People have spouses or children who die of cancer. I mean, that bad, bad stuff happens to civilians all the time. You don't have to go to a battlefield to experience trauma. And, you know, for most people who've been traumatized, civilian or military, you know, within some months, it usually resolves itself, particularly with counseling. And it did for me. And then, you know, eventually I was with American soldiers and I was embedded with a platoon of combat infantry in the Korangal Valley in eastern Afghanistan. And we were in a lot of combat, but more importantly than the combat, I experienced this profound connection and closeness with those guys. And I mean, I was there over and over again over the course of the year, and I really kind of became part of the platoon. And I honestly, like, I can honestly say, I mean, I was almost killed out there a couple of times. I mean, stuff happened, for sure. That was easy. What was hard, I mean, honestly, hard and heartbreaking, was giving up that group. And I'm not even a damn soldier. I'm a civilian. Even I was experiencing. I was twice their age, right? Like, I'm way outside the norm. But, and even I was greatly, greatly affected by it. And I came home, and I had symptoms that I knew from other soldiers, other vets, were really common. Like, I just cried all the time. It's stupid stuff. Like, I mean, literally at weddings and stuff like that. Like, I mean, one of those guys said to me, like, we're turning into girls. Like, what's going on? Why are we crying? You know, all this stuff, puppies and stuff like that. Like, what is going on with us? We used to be tough guys, and now look at us. So it wasn't even so the consequences of it weren't even the classic PTSD, like jumping at loud noises and, you know, whatever, forming, you know, like defensive positions in your living room. Like, no. It wasn't just that. It was some of that. But it was also just this extreme emotionality. And it leaked into my dreams, into my waking life. And I would have times when I just got so emotional, I had to leave wherever I was just because I just didn't want to embarrass myself. And I started to do research in that. You know, that's part of it, too. I mean, PTSD is a complicated thing. And frankly, it's not all bad. And I got to say, that emotional part of me opening up, honestly, it was about time. I mean, I was in my late 40s, you know, and I made it my whole life. I made it my whole life without ever having cried at something like, you know, like, what the hell is that? That's not a human being. What is that? And you know, now I honestly, like, as complicated as that experience was, it also, I feel like it also deepened me and kind of completed me in a weird way. And I feel very, you know, and I feel profoundly lucky, actually, that I went through that.
I have an email for you, Mac.
Yep.
Great stuff this morning. Sebastian's thoughts on homecoming, dislocation, how do we get to suicide? So, Sebastian, linkage between PTSD and suicide, yes, no. If so, why? If not, how do we get there?
Well, both PTSD and suicide are extremely complicated phenomena and very hard to quantify. And so creating a link is exponentially harder. But and I read a lot of studies about this. People who are more prone to PTSD are people who were traumatized in childhood before they were even entered the Army. People who experience violent or sexual trauma as children are particularly vulnerable to getting long-term PTSD. People who are vulnerable to suicide after deployment, statistically, are people who had psychological troubles before entering the military, who contemplated suicide before entering the military. Just statistically, those are predictors of suicidal behavior. Combat is not a very strong predictor of suicidal behavior. It's virtually unlinked to suicide. Deployment actually lowers your risk of suicide slightly, because people who are struggling psychologically are actually not allowed to deploy if they get treatment. So it's extremely, extremely complicated, but suicide is a tragic, obviously, it's a tragic problem. And, I mean, not only in among veterans, but in the United States as a whole. I mean, the suicide rate is climbing up to, 30 per 100,000, really, really, really high rates, in the general population, particularly, middle-aged males are particularly hard hit by suicide. So, most of the tragic suicides of veterans are Vietnam era veterans. They're not even young people, they're Vietnam era. And so it's an extremely complicated question. And, I think social scientists are just starting to sort of untangle it.
The Vietnam thing is, in my opinion, is very interesting. I mean, if you can imagine coming home to a society that's fragmented, and you go from a communal tribal society to an individual society, layer on top of that for the Vietnam veterans, a hostile society that doesn't want to deal with you and doesn't want to talk to you. I'm astounded that they didn't have more than they had, and I'm utterly amazed. And my therapist is a Vietnam veteran, and he's at the VA, and he's a special forces guy for Vietnam. And I asked him one day, I said, "Hey, when you talk to these Vietnam guys now, like, what do you talk about?" And he said, "The same thing I talk about with you." I said, "After all these years," and he said, "They never dealt with it. They came home and they stuffed it in the closet." And I think about that,
right.
and I was kind of thinking about that relative to your book in terms of, how the tribe takes care of its own, that sense of belonging. What you just said, we need you, and you get plugged in, and you go on, and you feel this incredible sense of warmth. To me, it's astounding that the numbers of depression and alcoholism for Vietnam veterans isn't higher, and I absolutely understand that, and as he told me, he said, look, they're retiring now. They have more time to think about it, right? And they never dealt with it. And that's what you're seeing in terms of a Vietnam veteran suicide rate climbing as well.
Right. Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of it that way. Of course, they're retiring. And, we know from catastrophes, like, the less time you have to think, like during the blitz in London, the less severe the consequences of psychological troubles, because you're just too busy, right? I mean, you're too busy carrying the wounded out of the rubble or whatever it may be. And retirement allows people to think, and it allows them to ruminate. And rumination, it's called anxious rumination. Rumination can lead to depression. It's linked to depression. One of the reasons psychologists think that one of the reasons women have higher depression rates than men, and this is across the board around the world, is because they tend to ruminate more. They just think more about life, and life's complicated and painful. And the more you think about it, the more depressed you get, I guess. But that's one of the rumination is one of the sort of earmarks of depression.
Sebastian Younger, for a few more minutes. The book is called Tribe. Text question for you, Mac. What advice would Sebastian give veterans as we come home and go back into this fragmented individual society? Sebastian, advice for veterans?
Wow, 30 seconds or less?
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, there's two levels to it. One is you got to take care of yourself and your family. I mean, you got to survive, right? So the first thing you do is create a community, a tribe around you where you feel supported, you feel safe, you feel like that old feeling that you felt overseas, you start to feel it again here. And that puts you in a safe place, and more important in some ways, it puts you in a place where you can help other people who are maybe even in more danger than you are, or suffering more than you are. And that's good for everyone. But the broader question is, why are you even having to do this? You should be coming back to a society which is already functioning as a group. You shouldn't need to create a subculture of a veteran subculture to get by psychologically. You should be joining society. That's the point. That's what you fought for, right? So once you've gotten yourself to a kind of safe place and a safe situation, all you guys and women, I mean, the veterans, like veteran community, you're multitudes, you know, you're young, you're strong. Like, this is your chance. Change us. Change society. Do it. I'm 54. I'm not doing it. You know, like, you guys do it. You're going to do it for your children, whatever. Like, don't let this stuff go on any longer, because it's going to keep crippling generation after generation, whether they fight wars or not. I mean, veterans are talking about it because they're in a particular position in society. It's affecting everybody. I mean, I was talking to a woman who was a nurse in a cancer ward, and she said, you know, a lot of the people who survive, I mean, you know, patients in a cancer ward are their own platoon. I mean, they're all helping each other. They're going, they're facing death. They're all facing death. Some of them survive and some don't. It's just like combat. And the people who survive come back to the cancer ward and they say, listen, I've come back because no one out there understands what we went through. You guys are the only people who understand, and I miss you. Well, who's that? What's that sound like? That sounds like veterans, right? And so it's happening to everybody. And I'm going to throw it back on that person, man or woman, I don't know which, but I'm going to throw it back on you. Like, man, we need you. Like, help, change stuff. Cause, we need to do something, but the society is killing everybody.
Final question for you. Cause the sheet in front of me says, 57 minutes after the hour, I'm done. So national service, I think, is a component of the solution, because you can grow up in this country and never serve anybody in your life and live like that. That's not the way our fathers grew up when there was a draft. And so I have the identical concept that you have in terms of national service. You owe this country something. Volunteer firefighter, volunteer cop, Peace Corps, VISTA, create civilian conservation corps again. But that experience welds you to the nation. It changes you forever, and you come back with the prism that you view the world a little bit different. Tell me about national service, Sebastian, and your thoughts on it.
Well, I think it would. I think the benefits would be many. I mean, it would give young people the experience, the feeling, the understanding that they're part of something greater that needs them, and that they don't get the benefits of it without participating. If you ask young people, if you ask anyone, what do you owe your country? I think you just get blind stares. You know, maybe someone would try to be funny and say your taxes. You know, I mean, literally, like, there's no idea that there's a grand enterprise we're all engaged in. And it would also, this is a divided country. I mean, politically, economically, racially, we're a really, really divided country. For a democracy, we're very divided. And the thing about the military and national service would do this as well. It throws everybody into the same pot and stirs them up. And that's a very, very healthy thing.
His name is Sebastian Younger. You've seen his work, undoubtedly. His documentaries, if you're in the military, are riveting stuff. He's written a book now called Tribe, along with many others. Sebastian, first of all, I want to thank you very much for coming on All Marine Radio today, taking an hour out of your time to talk to us and make us smarter. And God bless you. Thank you very much. And hopefully down the road, we'll do this again sometime.
Hey, thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you. There you go. That is Sebastian Younger. We appreciate his time this morning, an hour of his time. And the book, again, is called Tribe. It's a great read. I would recommend it to you wholeheartedly. More of All Marine Radio coming up next here on a Wednesday. Don't go away.